Welcome to rainy Phoenix, Arizona. It's not always like this, but it is for the next couple days, so enjoy it while it lasts. This past Friday was the opening ceremonies for the 2021-2020 Summer Olympic Games in Tokyo. Now, I love watching the Olympics. I enjoy seeing the greatest athletes from all over the world performing at the precipice of their talent in their respective fields. One of my favorite sports to watch in the Summer Olympics is track and field. Now, many years ago, none of you know this, but I was actually a high school track and field athlete. For those of you that don't know, the outdoor track is 400 meters long and it goes in a long oval. So in all my wisdom, I recognized that anybody running 400 meters or longer was simply running around in circles, and they always ended up where they started, and it seemed like a waste of time and a waste of energy to me. So I chose the short distances. I ran the 100-meter dash, the 200-meter dash. Those were my favorite races. Now, unfortunately, I did end up running the 400-meter dashes on multiple occasions, and much to my chagrin, that's another story. We won't talk about that today. Being a sprinter, I understood what it meant to be quick. The 100-meter dash was won or lost by hundredths of a second. Every part of the race is important. Your reaction to the gun, your explosion out of the blocks, your ability to attain maximum speed and then maintain that speed for the duration of the race. Form was important, your stride was important, your ability to accelerate to top speed, your arm swing was extremely important, and you may not know that. Any errors, any misjudgment would easily drop you from first place to dead last very quickly. This race is won in a matter of 10 or 11 seconds. So there's no time for recovery. There's no time for mistakes. There's no second chances. In and of itself, this is a difficult race to win consistently. Now let me introduce you to someone. This Olympian is a sprinter. In 2015, he won gold at the American Games in the 100-meter dash and the 200-meter dash. In Doha that same year, he also won gold in the 100-meter dash. In 2016, in the Rio Olympic Games, 100-meter dash, gold medal. And again in 2017 at the London World Olympics, this gentleman won the gold medal in the 100-meter dash. Now, I know what you're thinking. It's Usain Bolt. What if I told you it's not? Meet David Brown. David Brown was born in 1992, and at the age of 15 months, he was diagnosed with Kawasaki disease, which led to glaucoma and complete blindness by the age of 13. You heard me right. David Brown is completely blind. And yet he has won 5 gold medals in world championship and Olympic races in the last 6 years. David Brown runs at top speed, full out, completely blind. And maybe you're thinking to yourself, well, he must not do it very quickly. His top speed must not be the top speeds that we're used to seeing. He must do it slowly. He's unable to see. That's not true. In 2014, he became the first totally blind athlete to run the 100-meter dash in under 11 seconds, 10.92 seconds. I never ran that fast. I can see completely fine. This man is fast. He runs fast. He does not hold back. And I know what you're thinking, because this is what I was thinking. How in the world does he do that? How does this man run straight down the track every single time? How does he compete with others beside him, running in lanes beside him without running into somebody else or knocking him off course? How can he run at full speed and not run into anything? Meet Jerome Avery. Jerome Avery, as his shirt entails, is David Brown's Paralympic running guide. Jerome Avery and David Brown run each race together. Brown and Avery call themselves affectionately Team Bravery. Their motto is running for his glory. They're tethered together at the wrist with a small bungee-like cord, and that's how they stay together. That's how they run this race together. I'm going to give you a short clip of what this looks like. Try to look between their wrists. You'll see a little black line. That's the bungee cord tethered to them, possibly. I might... Oh, there it is. No, that's... Well, maybe we won't watch it. But either or, that's okay. That's them running right there. They're tethered together at the wrist. Unfortunately, the video isn't playing, but that's okay. It may look easy, but it's not. They start in blocks together. They explode. They have to hear and react to the gun at the same time. They explode out of the blocks, out of their starting position, at the same time, with the same stride length. Their arm action has to be precise. Their feet should be hitting the ground at exactly the same time. Their stride needs to be matched perfectly. They have to be synchronized together exactly. It should look like one person running. This was a video clip, but it's a still picture, I believe. There they are. They're in front. They're running together. That's David Brown and Jerome Avery. They look as though it's one person running that race. It's incredible. Now, David Brown is running this race in complete darkness. He needs to have a guide. He has to trust that person to get himself around the track. So what's your point today, Adam? Well, turn with me to 1 Corinthians 9. We're going to skim through this quickly. We don't have a lot of time to go through it detailed today. But 1 Corinthians 9 is where we're going to start. Paul is addressing the Corinthians, and he's making some statements about his rights as an apostle. He explains to them in verses 1 through 6 that as an apostle, he has a right to be given certain things. He talks about food and drink. He could take a wife if he so chooses. And in verse 12, he says he has a right to get support from the brethren as an apostle. He goes on to say he has not used these rights. He hasn't asked for any of these benefits that are due to him. And in verse 15, he says he would rather die than have someone deprive him of being able to say he never asked for those rights or demanded those. He'd rather die than do that. So what is Paul saying? Paul is saying this: humility is more important than your rights. His reward is not in what he rightfully is owed or what he rightfully should be given. His reward is in preaching the gospel and doing it freely with no expectation of benefits. That's in verse 18. And then he says, not only does he not request what is rightfully his as an apostle, but he also lowers himself in humility, becoming a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, he becomes like Jews to win the Jews. To those under the law, he becomes like those under the law to win those under the law. To those not having the law, he becomes like those not having the law to win those not having the law. So what are you saying, Adam? Does he change his belief? Does he do something he shouldn't do? Is he changing his religion? No. He's putting himself in a position of humility to not lord over them the rights and responsibilities and nobilities that are owed to him, that are due to him. He sums it up well in verse 22. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some for the sake of the gospel. Paul is saying it's more important to see people and treat people with kindness and gentleness and humility and respect than it is to demand what is rightfully yours. See people and meet them on their level. There is someone out there right now today who is running this race of life in complete darkness. They need a guide. You probably thought this sermon was all about David Brown and his accomplishments. And as fantastic and remarkable and as incredible as they are, that's not who this is about. Let me point you to the dynamic duo, the Paul of this dynamic duo, Jerome Avery. This man reminds me of Paul. Jerome is a guide. He's a helper. He gets no glory. His name doesn't go down in the record books as having the fastest time. He doesn't get the world recognition. He gets no prize money. He runs for the joy of helping the one that's racing that's impaired. He runs with the ones who can't run by themselves, the ones who are weak. Paul did the same thing. He became weak for those that are weak so he could help them win. There is someone today, and there's many people, I would assume, running this race of life in complete darkness. And they need to have a guide. They need someone to come up along beside them to guide them along that way. Stride for stride, step for step, all the way to the finish line. They need us. They need you. And I'm not just talking about out there existentially in the world. There are certainly opportunities, and the world is ripe for that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But first, there are so many people within these walls here today who just need someone to come up beside them, prop them up under their arm, and help them take that very next step. This world can be cold and cruel because it is so full of sin, it becomes dark and dismal, and that's scary. They need us to help them because they can't see what direction to go in. They don't know which way to start. They don't even know which direction to face. They need that guide. They need someone to point them in the right direction and for them to walk with them and help them each step of the way. They need you. They need us. That's what Paul's telling us. To the weak, become weak. Don't be too proud to humble yourself. Don't overlook others because you think you're better than them or you know more than them. To the weak, become weak. Now, I cannot imagine having to run a race blind. I can't even get across my bedroom in the middle of the night, stumbling and falling over the dog and hitting the bed. I can't do that. So I can't imagine running at top speed blind. It's impossible for me. But even more so, I can't imagine having to run a race tethered to another person. It seems awkward, restrictive, difficult. It's like a three-legged race. Nobody does that fast. It's a disaster, which is why it's so fun to watch. I can't imagine running a race being tethered to another person. But I could do that for someone that I loved, that I really knew needed the help, someone blinded by the world and running out of control and in darkness. And you could too. I believe that you could look around this room and you can find those people and you could say to yourself, I could do that. I could do that. I could help them. I'd be willing to make a sacrifice for their sake. And that's awesome. And I recommend find those people. Go do that. Some of you are thinking about someone in your mind, and you've got them on your mind this whole sermon. That is amazing. Go and do that for them. It's excellent. Get out there, do it. For any of you that have not thought of somebody yet, allow me to stretch you just a little further. I'm short, so I get the opportunity to say that. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Don't even the pagans do that? That was Jesus' words in Matthew 6, 43 and following. I have a hard time seeing myself tied to someone that I know and I'm trying to run with them. But I can't even begin to imagine being tied to my enemy and running with them. I could picture it being tethered to someone here, someone at church. I think we could all be tied to someone here, and we need to be. And I think we should be, and we should find those people and help them, absolutely. But aren't our enemies doing the same thing? Isn't that Jesus' point? He was saying, if you love those who love you, what reward will you get? If you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? What are we doing that makes a difference? I know there are people in here that need it, and I'm not talking about not helping them. We need to do that. We should. But what would it look like for you to run this race of life tied to the wrist of your enemy? What would that look like? Picture that person, your enemy, the place that you find them. Work, school, extracurricular activities, the store, I don't know, wherever it might be. I would imagine that you mostly try to avoid that person. You have this idea of where they're going to be and when you're going to meet them, and you go the other way. I understand that. But can you see yourself approaching your enemy and being kind to them? Can you see yourself seeing your enemy instead of attacking them or avoiding them or running away, or you put them first at work or school, extracurricular activities? Can you see yourself sharing, caring, even loving on them? Giving them a true representation of what Christ looks like on this earth, because Paul said we're doing it for the sake of the gospel and we share in its blessing. 1 Corinthians 9:23. And I think Paul gets this. You see, I think he really knows what it feels like. Because remember, Paul was that person once upon a time. He was the enemy. Paul was the guy running aimlessly through life, making mass destruction wherever he went, completely blind to the truth. He was one of the most hated Christian killers. He was the early church's biggest enemy. And God changed him. He blinded him, and then he gave him sight. So who's going to go find the next Saul turned Paul? Who's going to run with that person and take them from darkness to light? Or the next Roman centurion standing at the foot of the cross, who's going to take them and help them get to that finish line in life? Now, there's a final word of caution from 1 Corinthians 9. Paul's talking about how to be humble, how to help the weak, how to walk beside those who are struggling, to help point them the way to Christ and the way to God, to the gospel. And then we come to verse 24 and following. And Paul reminds us that as we're becoming humble, as we're becoming weak for those that are weak, that we can't do it half-heartedly. He reminds us that it takes every ounce of preparation, training, and dedication to complete this hard work. It's not a glorious job. It's not an easy job. But it's one that provides the greatest reward, a crown that lasts forever. I'm going to read 24 and following. Keep in mind, he's talking about going to the weak. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and I make it my slave so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. Paul's talking about making sure you're running the race right because you are running a race. You're leading people. Whether you want to or not, it's happening. You're alive. You are bringing others with you. People are going to be watching you regardless of which race you're running, regardless of which direction you're going. People are watching, and there will be people that join you, especially these ones. No matter what direction you're running, people will follow. And remember what Jesus said about the blind leading the blind, Matthew 15? If a blind man leads a blind man, both will fall into the pit. We have to set the pathway and guide and bring others in the same race along with us. It's not just for our glory, but it's to show others the right way. And if we aren't running this race with everything we've got, strictly training our body, mind, and soul, running this race with purpose, an objective, a goal, focusing on the finish line and practicing each day to get to that finish line. These gold medal athletes practice 6 days a week, hours upon hours. That's what he's saying. Run in such a way to get the prize. If we're not doing those things, how can we possibly expect to guide others in the right way if we're not doing it ourselves? If the guide runs off the track or runs outside the lanes or runs the wrong direction, they're disqualified. And that's what Paul said. Don't be disqualified. That's what he's telling us. Get yourself in training. Stick to the plan. Run the race right because it's our job to lead others. In humility, guide as much as possible. David Brown said in an interview something that caught my attention. He said when he started running with the guide, he thought he had to synchronize himself to his guide. But very quickly, he realized that is not correct. He said, no, I don't synchronize myself to him. The guide synchronizes himself to me. To the weak, I become weak. As guides, as ambassadors for Christ, we meet them where they are. And then we guide them on the right path, putting aside our pride and our arrogance and delivering people to God's eternal finish line. It's amazing. Jesus Christ's whole purpose was to help us get to heaven. Without him, we can't do it. The blood of bulls and goats are not enough to save us. Jesus became weak. He left heaven and became a man. And he walked this earth beside us and for us and to teach us the right way to go. He guided us to the finish line. I'm going to close with Proverbs 4, verses 10 through 13. It says this, "Listen, my son, accept what I say, and the years of your life will be many. I instruct you in the way of wisdom and lead you along straight paths. When you walk, your steps will not be hampered. When you run, you will not stumble. Hold on to instruction. Do not let it go, for it is your life." We're going to be led in a word of prayer in just a second. After that word of prayer, it will be time for us to be dismissed to our classes.